One of the dangers when anybody, Christian or not, thinks about Jesus is that we can think wrongly about him. What would he say to me? How would he respond to me? What does his reaction be to those that I know and love? Very often, if we're asked that question, we can get Jesus wrong. We can make him in our image. Well, I think Jesus would look like this, or I think Jesus would say these things. But one of the helpful things about opening up even those very familiar passages like this one is that our misconceptions of Jesus, even if we've been following him for many, many years, our misconceptions of Jesus can be brushed away, and Jesus can stand before us, stand amongst us, stand with us again, afresh. If we're a Christian, even the gospel can be mutated, warped in our minds. We are not yet perfectly holy. We still have hearts that are capable of loving sin and sinning. And so as long as we are in this waiting for Christ to return and perfect his bride, the people of God, we have the ability to mutate the gospel to something else, to change Jesus Christ, to diminish him somehow, that makes him less than he really is. And conversations like this just show us simple, basic truths that we can't afford to forget or neglect. I'm going to take three very simple steps through a very simple story. The first one is simply this. We're introduced to a man called Matthew. We've met him before. He's the author of the book. We've been looking at Matthew's gospel for quite some time. He's the one who pens this story. And many people think he's also called Levi in some passages. Many people think that his tax accounting mind of recording and keeping records of figures and sums and whatnot have been applied to recording the life of Jesus Christ. I think that's a helpful way of thinking about it. Here's a man who is methodical. And when we read Matthew's gospel, here's a methodical record of the life of Jesus Christ. We're told Jesus meets him in the tax booth. He's working. And Jesus simply says, in English, two words, follow me. And he arises and follows him. What's helpful here is this. In previous weeks, we've looked at people who have come to Jesus and said things, and he's taken them on in their understanding. But as he takes them on in their understanding, he's challenging what they believe. So you may remember a few weeks ago, a man came to Jesus, chapter 8, verse 19, and said, "Teacher, I'll follow you wherever you go." That sounds brilliant. But Jesus says to him, "Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, and the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. If you're going to follow me, be ready for cost and discomfort." And we summed that up by saying, following Jesus comes at a cost. Do you remember? Another man comes to Jesus and says, "Lord, let me first go and bury my father." And Jesus said to him, "Follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead." It's probably more likely that he's waiting for his father to die, and as he's waiting for his father to die, he's going to care for him and then follow Jesus. And Jesus teaches the man that following Jesus comes with a priority. It's not to be delayed or put off, even for otherwise honourable reasons. Well, here's Matthew, who follows at a cost. He gets up from his business. Tax collecting was a lucrative business. He would not have been a poor man. He gets up from his business and follows Jesus at a cost. He leaves that behind. There's no record of Matthew going back to his books or his business after this moment. He follows Jesus. That is the line now in Matthew's past. That belonged there. Now I'm following Jesus. He followed Jesus at a cost. And he also follows Jesus with a priority. Because what this man does next is, it looks like the house they gathered in for the meal is his house, and the people who are invited in are his mates, his fellow workers, tax collectors. Maybe it's a leaving do sort of thing. "Guys, I'm leaving work. Come and meet the man that will explain to you why I'm leaving." And then he gathers his friends. So the snide little comment that comes is tax collectors and sinners. And while Matthew invites them to his house to meet Jesus and the disciples, he's not saying, tell me what you think, and then I'll decide whether to follow him. He's saying, come and meet Jesus. Understand why I'm leaving work and following this man. Come and meet him for yourself. And he places Jesus above his friends and probably his family as well. So here is a simple record of one man following Jesus well, at a cost and with a priority. Matthew. Can you just click us on there, Philip, if that's okay? The next point is very simply this. It goes from Matthew to meal, and I've referred to that already. There's something special about enjoying a meal with somebody else, isn't there? There's time is allowed. Conversation can take place. Leisurely conversation. There's a commitment to spend time with that person. And when you invite someone to your house, you're letting them in. And you're asking them to let you in to their lives as well. That idea of intimacy is present when we host people, as it was when people like Matthew hosted people. But there's something else. A meal with Jesus. Meals in the Old Testament were usually meant to signify the sealing of a deal. An expression of, now we're one with one another, we're on the same side, we're walking together through life. In biblical terms, there's a covenant has been made, and a meal often seals that covenant. God had made a promise to somebody, and that person, in enjoying fellowship with God, is joining with him. And that seems to be the weight that many Bible commentators give to this simple invitation to Jesus to come to the house. Matthew and Jesus. Jesus and his disciples, Matthew and his friends, is this coming together and this inclusion. It's not just friendship that's going on. Jesus the King is making Matthew and probably some of his friends part of his kingdom. There's this covenant inclusion that's going on. And that's helpful to us, because what happens in the rest of Matthew's gospel helps us understand how it is that Jesus the King establishes the kingdom. Jesus is not just about friendship here with Matthew and his mates. This king will establish a kingdom by going to a cross and conquering death. Death is the payment that you and I, Matthew and his friends, deserve for sin. And Christ, in going to the cross, pays that price so that people like Matthew and his friends, like me and you, can be included in the covenant that God makes with his people. And as Matthew tells the whole gospel story, this little part of it, this meal with Jesus, fits into the big story. Matthew doesn't stop at the end of the meal in his record of Jesus' life. It's not the most important part. It is significant. It's not the most important. Jesus will carry on to the cross, conquer death, defeat sin, include people like him and us into the gospel story. And that's good news. And Matthew clearly wanted people to meet Jesus. For themselves. Don't forget the purpose of Jesus. We saw it crystallized more clearly last week when this paralyzed man is brought to Jesus, and Jesus first forgives him of his sin. In Matthew chapter 1 verse 21, Joseph is told he will save his people from their sins. This king is a sin forgiving, sinner welcoming king. And Matthew's experiencing that in this encounter. Lastly, in the story, mercy. There's a theme in Matthew, two themes sort of collide together. One is, as Jesus shows that he has the authority to invite people into the kingdom for which he'll pay a price at the cross, people will come. People like Matthew and his friends will come to Jesus and be brought in. But the other thing is that as people see Jesus do that, they will fume and despise Jesus and stand against him. Receiving the kingdom opposing the kingdom. And as the story of Matthew carries on, those two things intensify. More people come and more people oppose. Well, here's an early opposition. The Pharisees see Jesus in action, and they go to his disciples and they ask a question. So just imagine the Pharisees are in and around the house. And Jesus is at the table, maybe two of the disciples, for example, are just pulled to the side by the Pharisees. They're having this conversation privately, and they ask the question. You see what they ask him? Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? What's the issue with tax collectors? It's not just that they were rich. It's that they were traitors. Very often when a Western army goes into a foreign land, they employ translators, local people who will bridge the language gap between the army and the locals. The difficulty comes is when the army retreats and those translators are left in the local area. They're seen by their community as traitors. They've worked for the occupying force and army. Well, Matthew would be seen like that. He's working for the Romans in Israel. The Romans were not welcomed. And so his role as a tax collector categorized him as an undesirable, a cast off in the community. So not only was he, if you like, politically poisonous, they don't want him. Ceremonially, he would be affected as well, because his job would require him to work with Romans who were ceremonially unclean. They couldn't just walk into the temple. And Matthew, by contamination, would not be welcome at the temple at any time of the day. And so Matthew was despised. Tax collectors were despised. And his friends, who were, this phrase, sinners, seems to be a catch-all for people who the Pharisees just didn't like and couldn't handle and weren't following God's ways. Why? What's Jesus doing with them? The question is asked to the disciples, but Jesus knows what's going on. And so he answers the question. And the key issue is mercy. When they're standing there looking at Jesus, interacting with the tax collectors and sinners, the undesirables of the community, they're not thinking in terms of compassion and mercy, are they? They're thinking in terms of distance. We're here. We are followers of the law, and they were. They're over there, and we are distant from one another. They're contaminated. They're traitors. Do you remember I said at the start, we can mutate the gospel. We can take the good news of God in this world and his ways and change it, skew it. That's what the Pharisees were doing. And when we read about the Pharisees or sometimes the scribes, we can almost think, do you remember going to the pantomime? You ever been to the pantomime? The baddie comes on stage and the kids boo and hiss. And it's all a bit of fun. Well, quite often when we read the Bible stories and the Pharisees come on, we just tut and sigh and boo and hiss and think, well, they're going to get it wrong. But actually the way in which they mutate the good news of Jesus Christ, the way they skew how God is, can be a pitfall for us too. And Jesus deals with them. Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick, says Jesus. Go and learn what this means. That was a rabbi phrase said to students who had much to learn. Here, Jesus says it to the experts. Go and learn what this means. Then he quotes from the Old Testament, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. I came not to call the righteous, but the sinners. Let me explain that first phrase of the, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. It comes from Hosea chapter 6, verse 6. God's people in the time of Hosea are in trouble. They don't know it, but they are. The problem is this. They're going through the motions of a religious life. They're turning up at the temple. They're bringing their sacrifices. They're saying their prayers. The community see them going and see them coming. They're doing everything that they're supposed to do. And yet, these religiously behaving people are mistreating the community and those who are in most need of kindness and compassion. And God holds that standard highly. God is a God of mercy and compassion, and he expects his people to be people of mercy and compassion. And when they're not, when they're religiously behaving but not caring for the needy, he holds them to account. And he held them to account through Hosea's day by saying, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Now, sacrifice is important. He wasn't saying, forget sacrifice. The order. They had sacrifice, but not mercy. They weren't being compassionate. And God was instructing them through Hosea to have mercy over sacrifice. And Jesus, in using that little phrase of prioritizing mercy over sacrifice to these people in his day, he was saying, there are community cast-offs who should know your kindness and mercy, not your distance. If you are genuinely religious, if you're a follower of God, your heart of mercy and compassion should be towards them, as mine is, Jesus is teaching. In other words, they get God wrong. Secondly, they get themselves wrong. This is important. They get themselves wrong because they think they're okay with God, and the sinners and tax collectors aren't. But Jesus shows that his mission, and this should shape our minds and shape our hearts, both in terms of receiving what Jesus has come to do and being changed by him to work with him. Jesus teaches in the same way as a doctor is busy amongst the sick, not the well. So he has come, God has come on earth to deal with the sinners, not the righteous. Now, Jesus is not saying that the Pharisees are righteous. He's saying that they've designated that title, that phrase, to themselves. They think they're righteous. They think that without God, they're okay. So it's not, Pharisees, you're okay, you don't need me, I've come for these bad lot. It's actually, I've come for sinners, I've come for people who know they need me, not for people who think they're okay without me. At no point does Jesus have a conversation with anybody in his life and tell someone, you're okay without me, off you go. You're okay with God, I need to deal with those who aren't, let me deal with them. He doesn't say that. His mission is to sinners, people who need him, and sinners are recognized before Jesus as those who come to him acknowledging their need of him. Those who think they're okay without him, or those who think they've got enough in their life to not have Jesus, are considered self-appointed righteous. And Jesus burst in that bubble with these religious behaving people. Because of the people Jesus came for, there is hope. Christ hasn't come for the well-behaved. Christ hasn't come for the good people. Christ hasn't come for those who can tick boxes and say that they've behaved through life for many years, or they've turned their own life around without Jesus and they've now started to behave. That is not what Christ has come to do. And the significance of that is this, that only through Jesus Christ are we put right with God. That is the only way that eternal life in the new creation can be enjoyed. People, me, you, must come to Jesus and acknowledge we need him. Like Matthew, to be brought into a covenant, like the paralyzed man, to be forgiven of sin, like those before who follow at a cost and with a priority, but they come to Jesus acknowledging, I'm not righteous, I need you. There's a warning here in this message of hope. And the warning is, don't fall for the same delusion as the Pharisees, who thought they were okay without Jesus. But there's a welcome here. Anybody who knows that they need to be helped, healed, forgiven, cleansed by Jesus. Anybody, tax collectors of the day, sinners, the filth of the society. Anybody can come to Jesus and they will be made righteous. Not because of how they behave primarily, but because of their relationship with Jesus Christ. As I've said before, go on to die for their sins that they may be forgiven. There is hope. There's a warning. Don't fall for the same pattern as the Pharisees. But there's a welcome. Anybody can come. Most of the people in this room are believers. Probably most of the people watching at home are believers, but it's possible that some of you aren't. So can I extend, on behalf of God's revelation through this passage, there is an invitation through Jesus Christ to come to God. It's an invitation that's open to people who know they need Jesus and must have him to be right with God. You can take that invitation today. Even before I finish speaking, you can speak with Christ and ask him to cleanse you. Ask him to receive you and bring you in like he did with someone like Matthew. Ask him to bring you in. There is hope. And if I could just speak to Christians for a few moments, there is always hope. Do you remember that mutation of the gospel? One man puts it like this. After we become a Christian, there is the common, what he calls the common aftermath. And that is this, that we've come to Jesus knowing we need to be forgiven. But as we grow as Christian, even in the first few weeks or months, and in the years that follow, we realize that actually our hearts were darker than we thought they were. Our minds think thoughts that we wish they didn't. And actually things look much worse than they first did, even before we became a Christian. One man describes the Christian heart as a haunted house heart, where all sorts of thoughts and feelings come out. And as we grow as Christians, we realize just how haunted it is, how dark it is, how capable of things that displease God we are. And we might just think, do you know what? I've blown it. We might just think, I know Jesus forgave me then, but would he forgive me now? The answer is, of course he will. He's come, not for the well-being, he's come for the sinner. And if he's come for the sinner, he knew what he was getting when he saved you. He knew all the depths of darkness and fears and insecurity and rebellion. He knew the whole lot. And when he rescued you, it's you who are learning about your heart. He knows everything. So when you find out, Christian, that your heart is a darker place than you first suspected, and that your life is often characterized by more wandering than you thought was even possible, there is good news. Because there is always hope. And as a Christ has come for sinners. And as you come to Christ and depend upon him and ask him again for his cleansing and his forgiving and his enabling, you're growing. You're growing as a Christian. It may not feel as if you are, but you're growing as a Christian. Why? Because you're looking to Jesus more than you're looking to yourself. And that's the exact opposite to the Pharisees, who were looking to themselves more than Jesus. So as you look to Christ more than yourself, Christian, be assured you're growing. And Christ is becoming more precious. There is always hope. Beware the mutation of the gospel, Christian, that can happen in your heart. Christ came for sinners, not the righteous. Beware those of you who aren't Christians and thinking that somehow you'll get a cold shoulder from Jesus when you come to him. You won't. You will get an eternal embrace, like Matthew did, of love and forgiveness. And that is good news that you can benefit from today. Receive the life that Jesus gives through the cleansing that he achieved at his death and resurrection. Let me pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for the covenant that is made through Jesus Christ of coming to sinners and making them his. If that's not us yet, would you make us yours? If that is us, would you assure us out of our insecurity that you are a God who never lets go? Teach us how sinful we can be, that we may be increasingly dependent upon you. Have mercy upon us, O God. Amen.